is a great church, and a lot we can learn from this church. Talk
Does
about
he have the perfect one?
Of discipleship from the church at Philadelphia.
What are you saying?
So if you found your place there, I'm going to read verses 7 through 13. And look at the church there in Philadelphia. The angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth and no man shutteth, and shutteth and no man openeth. I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thee, thy feet, and to know that I love thee, because thou hast kept the word, my patience. I also will keep thee from the hour of temptation, which will come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar of the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God. And I will write upon him my new name. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches.
So part of the same
Peter, would you open us in prayer this morning?
Well, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to hear your word. Lord, I just ask that you would preach today and let him speak what you have to speak. In your name I do pray. Amen.
Amen. Well, we see this church here in Philadelphia, and it was a church that stands out because they did not have a rebuke. Many of the other churches, we read about something that they did, and the Lord was not pleased with them. But the church of Philadelphia had no specific rebuke, and they were doing some things well. They had a servant's heart, I believe, and they had a shepherd's heart. As a church, they had what I would see as the spirit of adoption. They wanted to reach out to others and to bring others to a knowledge of the Lord, and they were very effective at that. But one of the things that stands out about the Church of Philadelphia,
Peter's answering Tim.
I see this through several of the words that are mentioned here, but they were a church that lived up to their name. They were a church of brotherly love. When we looked at the end of the book of Hebrews,
she's connecting it to a speaker.
We just lost the sound here.
Mom, we can't hear him. Peter, turn the sound up.
There's no sound here.
Can you hear this?
Yeah.
I can actually understand.
And we see that illustrated through shepherd. David was a shepherd. In fact, when
he took my pen.
Samuel came among the king among Jesse's sons, of course, David was out with the sheep, and he was almost an afterthought. He was an afterthought. Samuel had to actually push him a little bit to see if he had another son. You know, do you have any others? And he was, well, yeah, I guess he was one out there in the field with the sheep. But David was a shepherd. He had a shepherd's heart. He cared about people. And we see that God used David, and David became a man after God's own heart. And a great illustration of that was how he took care of the sheep, and how there he goes up against the lion and the bear, and he protected those sheep. He did it in the strength of the Lord, and he cared about those sheep. And Jacob was also a shepherd. Jacob took care of Laban's cattle, and he was a shepherd out there with them. And, he did a great job taking care of them, and they did well under the hand of Jacob. And he learned to take care of them and to be patient with them. And when Jacob met Esau, it was the day after he had wrestled with the Lord late that night before, or just before that, and he wrestled with him and said, I won't let you go unless you bless me. And he wanted a blessing from the Lord. He craved a true blessing from the Lord. And he was sincere as he pursued God. And he said, I don't want a pretense of a blessing. I don't want a form of a blessing. I want a true blessing. And he wrestled with God for that true blessing. And God gave it to him. And God said, what is your name? And he said, Jacob, which of course, Jacob means supplanter or deceiver. He was a deceiver. He had been deceptive about how he had lied to his dad to get the blessing from his dad. Esau's blessing. But there's a lot to that as well. But he had done some deceptive things throughout his life, and he was known as a deceiver. But he wanted to be truly blessed by God and to have a true walk with God. And God said, "Your name will be Israel." For as a prince, he had found favor in the eyes of God. He had touched the heart of God. And the idea of a prince was he had some influence, he had some authority, he had some power in the eyes of God. And when he met up with Esau, shortly after that, Esau told Jacob, let's all head back to the house. You know, essentially they had gotten together and the Lord allowed them to rebuild that relationship. And God had been very gracious to Esau and they were actually able to have a civil talk and have a decent relationship there. But Esau said, let's all head back to the house. And Jacob said, let's just take a little bit of time in because the children are tender. And he said, we don't want to overdrive them. We don't want to push them too hard because they need a little bit of time. We can't move too quickly because they're gonna get worn out. So we just need to take some time. And regardless of all the different dynamics of why he said that, that principle is a powerful principle in our walk with God. Israel is the apple of God's eye. They are the people of God, God's own people. And Israel, they're the descendants of Jacob. This man was blessed with God, and he illustrated a principle for us that's a powerful principle in our walk with God, and that is we need to be patient with people. I believe the church at Philadelphia was patient with people. And I believe Pastor Asquith is especially patient with people. And that's one of the great, that's one of the great blessings, I believe, of this church, one of the great keys of this church. God is doing a work in this church that I haven't seen a lot of other churches, and it's encouraging to me to see it. It's inspiring for me to see what God's doing. But one of the keys here is being patient, allowing God to do his work in his time. We seek his heart, and we seek earnestly, just like Jacob did, but we don't pray for a minute and get up and say, well, I prayed, but we seek God when we're looking for answers. We don't say, well, I tried and I'm just going to do whatever. No, we continue to seek God and we're going to see him and get his leadership on our lives and on our specific steps in our lives and be patient in our walk with him, but then extend that patience also to others and care about others and receive others when they are difficult. Okay? We comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, and we are patient toward all men. And this is something we can learn from the church at Philadelphia. Another thing about flipping back to David, David was a shepherd. David was a man after God's own heart. David was anointed by Samuel to be the second king of Israel. And of course, God blessed the kingdom of David in a great way. And Jesus came as a descendant of David. But we see in David's life that when he ran from Saul, because Saul wanted to kill him for jealousy, not because he had done anything wrong, but David ran from Saul. He was out in the running in the mountains in the wilderness. And it says there, when he was out there, that everyone that was in distress and everyone that was in debt and everyone that was dis- contented, gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. They were in distress. They were discontented. They were the rough crowd. But they all felt comfortable with David. They all came and gathered around David. Isn't that neat? Even that blind man, Bartimaeus, who sat by the gate of Jericho, he said, "Jesus of Nazareth, thou son of David, have mercy on me." He still remembered how David had been kind to those who were disabled and who couldn't help themselves. David helped those who couldn't help themselves, those who were in a bad place in life. David was known as a man who was patient. And he reached out to who was it in Lodabar? Mephibosheth in Lodabar. And he came and ate at the king's table. This was a man who had a shepherd's heart, who was patient with people. And God blessed his leadership because he was patient with people and he sought God's heart patiently. And I also believe this is the key that we see here at the church at Philadelphia. So to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, here in Revelation 3, verse 7, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, right? These things that he is holy. God is a holy God. We cannot serve him if we do not care about being holy. We have to care about his holiness and seek to be holy. He said, "Be holy, for I am holy." We ought to be concerned about being like him and realize that it's going to take some time to grow in our walk with him. And you know what? We're never going to be sinless in this world. But we can sin less, we can grow, we can be removed from sin and sin less and less. God can change our lives and grow us closer to him, and we can be conformed to his image as we find power in Christ. He's patient with us, but he desires for us to be holy. We can't just throw away this thing of being holy and say, "Well, you know, everybody's got their problems, and we'll all just continue to just, you know, you got your thing, I got my thing, and you know, we all can just agree to disagree, and you know, the Bible is just a matter of interpretation." No, the Bible is like a knife; it cuts, it's sharp, and a two-edged sword. It divides between the joints and the marrow. This is a divine truth, and it's a powerful truth, and it's a clear truth. And God's a holy God. He must be recognized as holy, and he must be worshipped as holy. And so we need to pursue him patiently as a holy God. This doesn't mean that we just throw away holiness, no. But we recognize him as a holy God. So to the church of Philadelphia, he said, "These things said he that is holy, he that is true." God does not delight in the lie. This is one of my prayers for our country right now. I believe there's a lot of lies being circulated in the direction of our country. And I'm praying that God would expose the hidden things and bring to light the hidden things, and that God would bring the truth about the direction of our nation. Yes, we need grace, but we also need the truth to be known about a lot of these things that have been going on. And specifically, I'm concerned about the election. I don't think that the truth is being told about that. And we need to be praying that God would allow the truth to come to light. As a nation, we need to be concerned with the truth. And God is concerned with the truth. Listen, if you lie, if you think it's funny to lie, I remember I was in high school, the kids would always, other teens, and I would too, you know, tell a lie and laugh about it, you know, just kidding, you know, whatever. But we have to be careful with being deceitful. We have to be careful with not lying lightly. We have to take the truth very seriously and speak the truth. And speak it in love, but speak the truth. God's a God of holiness, and he's a God of truth. These are two outstanding characteristics of God. And notice this also, and this is a little bit of a different thing that we don't hear about a whole lot in other passages throughout Scripture. But he says this, and he that hath the key of David, the key of David. Well, what was the key of David? Honestly, I don't know exactly what the key of David is. Pastor Askew was here today. I probably asked him, what is the key of David? He probably has a good answer for me. I don't know what the key of David is. But I do know this, that God blessed David. And there was something in David's life that was a key to walking with God. And he was a man after God's own heart. I do know that. And he was a man with a shepherd's heart. And God blessed David. But the Bible says he has the key of David. The church of Philadelphia, their God, the God of David, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their God, had the key of David. And notice he says, he that openeth, and no man shutteth, and shutteth, and no man openeth. God can open hearts. Listen, you want to have an open opportunity to share the gospel? Maybe you tried to share the gospel with someone, and they said, you know, I'm all set, or, you know, that's fine for you, or whatever they might say, and they walk away, they don't want to hear. Listen, God can open the door for the gospel to be spoken. God can open the door for a life to be changed. God can open that door. And God has the power to do that. Verse 8, I know thy works. We looked at, we're talking about Hezekiah this morning. We're talking about, I was talking about and looking at their studying there in the Old Testament as he broke up that brass serpent. And he said, it may be that God will hear. They told Isaiah, it may be that God will hear. God does hear. God does see. And he said to the church at Philadelphia, he says this, I know thy works. I know what you're doing. God sees what we're doing when nobody else sees. God sees the games we play, the things we watch, the words we speak, the places we go. He knows our works. You say, I want to be an effective witness. I want to bear much fruit. I want to abide in the vine. Good. God sees your works and he cares. Would you think that grace, that this is an idea that we have in our society, that grace is like a get out of jail free card, you know, you sign up and you can just do whatever you want and it's all under the blanket of grace? That's not the God of the Bible. The grace of God that brings salvation that appeared to all men, it teaches us to deny ungodliness and worldly lust, live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. That's the grace of God that brings salvation. Grace changes us. Grace makes a difference. God knows our works. He sees what we're doing. He knows our works. And as a church, we need to build up one another. There's so many little jabs and sarcastic remarks and things that go on in the average church. It should not be. We ought to build one another up. And there's a place for it in good fun. If you know that it's something that you can have a little bit of fun with somebody and you know where they're at. But a lot of times it's not good natured. And I've seen it many times where people are not nice to each other. God sees that. And if we're not going to be kind to one another, God can't bless our lives like he'd like to. God sees our works. He knows how we treat the saints and the people in church. He knows how we treat the world outside these doors. He sees our works. And notice what he did. He said he had the key of David, and he can open the door that no man can shut. He can shut a door that no man can open. And he says, I know your works. Behold, notice, pay attention to this. I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast had a little strength, and has kept my word, and has not denied my name. He says, I've set before you an open door. He set before us an open door. If we will do right in his eyes, if we'll seek his heart and find his strength to do right and actually care enough to live our lives in a way that would please him by his power, he's going to set an open door before us. He's going to allow us to have a gospel witness that will be effective with the people around us and allow us to be able to make a difference. He said, I'm the one that has the key of David. I'm the one that opens the door, and no man shuts it, and shuts the door, and no man opens it. And I know your works. Behold, I set before you an open door. He saw their works, and he set before them an open door. So we would wonder, what was the church in Philadelphia doing that allowed them to have this open door? What made them different that they had this open door set before them? So So, the church at Philadelphia, behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet and to know that I have loved thee. So when some of the synagogue of Satan, they say they're Jews, but they're not Jews. These could be those in Jerusalem that he was referencing. And but I also see pictured here that there was, of course, the synagogue there in Jerusalem, and many of them had not received Christ. Many of them had said that they were the children of Israel. They were the descendants of Abraham, but they did not walk after the faith of Abraham, and they did not receive the Messiah that God had sent to them. And so they said that they were Jews, but they were not. They were the synagogue of Satan. But here's what I also see, and maybe more applicable for our lives, that God knows the wheat and the tares in his church. And I believe that there's many in the church, whether here or other churches or around the country, around the world, people that come to church, they dress like, you know, that they dress well, they follow the rules of church, they're faithful to services maybe, but they don't have a heart after God. And God knows that they're not saved. And God knows who those people are. And God's going to touch the hearts of the hypocrites when we are not hypocrites. He'll use our life to touch the heart of the hypocrites. And you say, yeah, shame on those hypocrites. But aren't we all at times hypocrites? We say one thing and we do another. We need to seek God's heart so that we would be sincere, so that we would be true as God's church. We seek his heart and walk in the Spirit so that we can be sincere, so that we can be true, so that we can be actually walking with God. And as we do that, as we are God's people, God will work through our lives to touch the heart of even the hypocrites. Maybe they're stone-faced, they've been in church for decades, and it doesn't seem like they're ever meant to change or ever admit that they need a closer walk with the Lord, but God can touch their hearts, and they'll come and worship before our feet. That is to say that they're going to look at the path that God takes us and see how God's worked in our lives, and they're going to be humbled by that and realize that they need that truth that's worked in our lives. But notice this, at the end of that verse, he says, they're going to come and worship before they feed and to know that I have loved thee. Love is best taught. We learn how to love someone by watching somebody who knows how to love. When God expresses his love to us, it allows us then to be able to reflect that love to the world around us, so that they also desire to have a love for God. God loves us, and they see God's love reflected on our lives. I think of that woman who came to anoint Jesus in Simon the leper's house. And of course, Simon was criticizing her as a sinner and said, you know, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him because she's a sinner. But Jesus talked to Simon about that, and he said to Simon, he said, if the Lord, if two are forgiven, one of 50 pence and one 500, who's going to love them most? And Simon says, well, whoever's forgiven of the most is going to love them the most, right? And Jesus said, yeah, you rightly judge. And he said, see this woman? And he went and talked about how she had anointed his feet and how she had wept there and how he said that she loved much. See, how am I going to know that God's loving and how am I going to love him much? And he gives a simple principle. He says, to whom she loved much. He said, wherefore I say unto thee, her sins which are many are forgiven, for she loved much. The evidence that her many sins have been forgiven was her much love. And then he said these words that ought to haunt every one of us. He said, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And of course it's impossible to be forgiven of a little if you've actually been forgiven of everything. Because none of us have only a little to be forgiven of. There's no such thing. Okay? So if you've only been forgiven of a little, that means you only scratched the surface of what needs to be forgiven. And if we are forgiven of little and love little, we need to dig in a little bit deeper and find true forgiveness and true salvation. And when we do, we're going to realize that we have been forgiven of much. And it is in receiving that much forgiveness that we learn to love Him much. We can't appreciate, we can't love the Savior unless we realize how much He had to forgive us of. And when we do that, it's going to change our hearts. And it's going to also be reflected to those around us as we walk with them and care about them and as we reflect His love to the world around us. We need to be forgiven of much so that we can love much and they will know that He has loved us. Look at verse 10 now. Revelation 3, verse 10. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I also will keep thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. He said, thou hast kept the word of my patience. The word patience is a big word. It's an important word. The word patience is key to walking with God and making a difference in the lives of those around us. James said it this way, James that was raised with the Lord, he said, let patience have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. We need patience. And they say, you know, we shouldn't pray for patience, but we need patience. The church at Philadelphia has patience. Anna's smirking at me because she knows I struggle with patience. So I'm not an excellent example of patience all the time. Well, I'm getting better, I think. Okay, God's working on me, all right? And hey, at least I can preach the message. And maybe if nobody else is helped by this, I can help myself. Because we need patience. We need patience.
We also know
right?
That very godly.
Can I get a witness? We need patience. This church in Philadelphia has patience. They worked with people and were patient with people. They were patient unto all toward all men. And God blessed them and He set this open door before them. They were patient. He said, behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. We need patience. And patience means that we're going to have brotherly kindness toward those around us. Listen, when somebody gets under our skin, somebody's stepping on our toes, this happens all the time, okay? The more you're in ministry, the more that you minister to people or try to reach out to people, try to just be a good Christian and care about those around you, the more you're going to find out people are going to try to get under your skin, they're going to try to be irritating, they're going to try to be frustrating. And so we need to have patience with people. Take a breath, extend grace to them, pray for them, move on, continue to show the law of kindness like that virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. Use the law of kindness, have patience with people, and we can make a difference that way. Look at Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 25, here's a call to kindness. You want to be kind? Jesus told us we need to be kind to people, care about those around us. Matthew chapter 25, verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in His glory, and the holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory. This is Matthew 25, verse 32. And before Him shall be gathered all nations, and He shall separate them one from another, as the shepherd divideth the sheep from the goats. Listen, that's His job. He divides the sheep from the goats. And He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on His right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hunger, and He gave me meat. I was thirsty, and He gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer Him, saying, Lord, when saw we
thee and hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink, when saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee, or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? The king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. I think one of the most outstanding things about what Jesus is saying here is that in the day of judgment, that when he judges, he's going to say, you know, you came to me in prison. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was hungry, and you fed me. And the righteous are literally going to stand there and say, but when did that even happen? I don't even remember that happening. When did this happen? I don't remember helping you with any of these things. And this is a key to being patient with people. It's just the way that a Christian learns to do things. They take in strangers. They feed the hungry. They visit those that are bound. We do the things that we can as God leads us. We're patient with people. And it's not like it's any great, grandiose thing. We're just doing what we can as God gives us opportunity to do it. That's it. And the church in Philadelphia did what they could as they had opportunity to do it. They were patient with people. They didn't go there to get some great accolades. They didn't think anybody was even watching. They didn't think anybody even really cared. They just said, you know, I think God would be pleased with this, and I'm just going to go ahead and reach out to the stranger. I'm going to go ahead and help this person that's hungry. I'm going to go ahead and like, Dale, go into the prisons and preach. Not that it's some great thing, but it's just what we can do. We're doing what we can to be a help. And God sees that, and he blesses that. And notice also this emphasis on, and as much as you have done it unto one of the least of these, you've done it unto me. God's emphasis from cover to cover in this Bible is on a personal relationship with us. One-on-one, he works with people one-on-one. He wants to have a relationship with you personally. I love each of my children. Abigail's here this morning, and Bethany and Lydia. Each of them here this morning, they're growing, they're learning, okay? But I can't be a mediator between God and my children. They have to find Christ themselves. They have to hear his voice themselves. They have to have a personal walk with him. And God, the Lord Jesus said right here, he said, as much as you've done to one of the least of these, we need to reach out to individuals. We look at the hundreds of millions of people across our nation and say, man, there's so much confusion. There's so much deception going on in our land. And there is. And how do we change America? It's changed one person at a time. We reach out to a person and care about them sincerely. Value a person more than the other things of life. But we value souls, and we look at souls. And just like the Apostle Paul reached out to Onesimus and took him under his wing, and he said it was his own son. They had begotten the faith, and he said to Philemon to receive him as his own self. He adopted that young man. He sent him back to do the right thing, and he showed him the gospel. He cared about him. He took him very seriously and valued him. We need to value people and value individuals one person at a time. And that's Pastor Asper's vision and burden. The website, onesoulattime.net. That's his vision. That's his heart. And it's true. We need to reach people one at a time. Notice what happens if we're not reaching individuals. He says, verse 41 in Matthew 27 here, and then he shall say unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, in everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and he gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and he gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and he took me not in. Naked, and he clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and he visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee in hunger, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. Notice he said it again. He said to those who had not done this, he said, as much as ye have done it not unto one of the least of these, ye done it not unto me. I don't believe you said because you missed somebody in the world and you left one person, you know, therefore, you know, you're guilty. No, he said he never ministered to one single person. He hadn't reached one person. You haven't cared about one person. You haven't took one person in and cared for them and ministered to them. And because of that, they were not his disciples. We need to reach out to individuals and love individuals. 1 John is filled with different verses that talk about us loving others and expressing God's love to others. 1 John chapter 3, verse 11 says, "For this is the message that ye heard from the beginning, that we should love one another." 3:23, "And this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son Jesus Christ and love one another as he gave us commandment." 1 John 4:7, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. For beloved of God so loved us, we ought also to love one another." And then 1 John 4:12 says this. It says, "No man hath seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us." God's given us this great opportunity to show love to others around us, whether it's in the church building or out of these doors out in the world around us. God has given us the opportunity to love those around us. And that is how we are able to express our love to him. I don't have any address, and I can't go to some address in Black Creek or Cuba or the city of Buffalo or anywhere. There's no address where I can go and knock on the door and say, "Hey, is God here? I wanted to bring him some fresh baked muffins." It doesn't work that way. No man has seen God at any time. God's a spirit. I worship him in spirit, but I can express it by showing love to others. Right? I express it by reaching out to the people around me. And if I'm not doing that, I'm missing the opportunity that God's given me. So I need to show love to others. I'm just going to wrap this up here with just an illustration of thought. And I'm sure you've heard this before, but I think it's good for us to be reminded of this and to think about this. The value of one. We can change the world by reaching one person. And this is absolutely true. After Elijah was up on Mount Carmel and called fire down from heaven and burned up the altar and the sacrifice and all the water, he had that great victory. He had prayed and it didn't rain for 3.5 years. He was hoping to turn the hearts of Israel back to their God. And when he got that message from this messenger from Jezebel, that she wanted to kill him after all this, and after he had already killed the prophets of Baal, yet it didn't seem like the people of Israel were turning back to the God of Israel, he went and just hid himself. He went under a juniper tree, which is a picture really of, I think it was a picture of miscarriage, but he went and hid under that juniper tree, and he went and hid himself in a cave, and God came to him. He said, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" I mean, those were probably biting, difficult words for him to hear, but he didn't see his purpose. He didn't see how he was making a difference, because he felt like he went, he had prayed so hard, he had called the fire down from heaven, but it seemed like, I don't think he knew how many Obadiah had been hiding there, but it seemed like he wasn't really making a difference. And God came to, first he gave him something to eat, and help strengthen Elijah. But God came by, and he came by in a strong wind, in an earthquake, and in a fire. And God wasn't in the strong wind, he wasn't in the earthquake, and he wasn't in the fire. But what was he in? What was God in?
Still small voice.
The still small voice. That's where God was. You know, I want to change America. Yes, I do. And I'm going to get down on that, and we need to fervently and effectually pray that God will change America. I want to change the world. I do. I mean, that was when my first was born. I said, you know, honey, you're going to change the world. You know, God's going to use you to change the world. I just hope God's going to use your life in a great way. I do. I hope she changes the world. I want to change the world. But God may not be in the earthquake, the strong wind, and the fire. He's in the still small voice. And it's when God touches the heart of a man, God touches the heart of a girl and a lady, when God touches the heart of a person and changes them, He does a mighty work. And that is the key to changing America and changing the world. And we need to invest in one soul at a time. We need to invest in individuals. When all the dust of life settles, what is going to really matter most? It's not going to be our assets. Jesus said, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. It's not going to be our social standing. Jesus said, woe unto you when all men speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. It's not your social standing. It's not your assets. It's not your intelligence. Paul wrote, where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? The abilities that we have, they are to be tools for God's work. For God to use those things for His work, for something that lasts. They're temporary tools, not to be worshipped, but to be used for a greater purpose. When the dust of life settles, what will matter most is your personal walk with God and the souls that you've reached for Him. The lives that you've touched for His glory. Jesus said, inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. I had the opportunity to talk to a man I was out witnessing, and we actually had come to his door, and was we were reaching the community in Catarize when I planted the church there, and talked to him, and he was an atheist. He was an outspoken atheist, and he said, I got no time for this, and you know, and he found out that I'm a creationist. He said, you believe that Earth's 6,000 years old? I said, yeah, it's about 6,000 years old. He said, oh, that's crazy. That's crazy. I've heard a lot of different arguments. I like to talk about the science of it. I think there's a lot of very good science that supports the Bible, and whether it's genetics, all different fields, the biochemistry, carbon dating, the radiocarbon dating, all these different the fields, I think they point toward an Earth that's not millions of years old. And the other thing is that these millions of years, they don't explain anything. They really don't. There's still no mechanism for progress in Darwinism. So I like to discuss this stuff. I'm getting on a bunny trail. I might do that sometimes. Okay. But this is what I talked to him about. He brought up this argument I've never heard before. And it was a bad one, but I never heard this before, and there's probably a reason I hadn't heard it before, but it puzzled me, because I never heard anybody even say this before. He said, you can't believe the Earth is 6,000 years old. He said, there's over 7 billion people on Earth, and there's not enough time in 6,000 years to have 7 billion people. I was like, well, I never did the math on it. I never really calculated it out or anything. I thought, well... I'm sure there is. I don't think that's that hard to do that. I said, I think that if there is enough time, it wouldn't be that hard. Anyway, I try not to get argumentative with him, and I try to talk to him about things that matter more, and just try to leave him with a good impression, let him know that I cared about him, and that I hope that he knew that I cared about him, and I just moved along. Okay? So then when I got back in the car, Leanna was with me. And I had to get out my phone. I started pushing logs and exponents, and I'm like, I gotta figure this out. Like, how long did it take? How long did it take to do this 7 billion people? So I find out it's super easy. I mean, you have to have 2.3 children per generation or something, in order to have 7 billion people. Because you just have to have a little bit more than reproducing the parents. I mean, it doesn't even take one, because there's all these generations. 6,000 years is, you even have 50 years a generation, which is a lot. I mean, you divide it out, it's 120 generations. So you've got an exponent of 120. It doesn't take that much. So then I got curious with it, and I'm like, And I told the man this too. I said, I'm from a family of 10, And I said, in powers of 10, those add up quick, It's not quite powers of 10 because, you have to divide the parents, so it's actually,
each of the kids have 10, it's 10 more 10, like, just...
speaking world, you know, five in our case. But I mean, that's a lot, you know, 5, 25, 125, just a day long, it goes up pretty quick. So I started thinking about it, and I said, well, we have a big family, we're younger. And so I found out that at this point, we have 8 children, and my wife and I, our average age is only 36. I'm a little bit of a geek, so you might be turning this off and sleeping anyway, but this kind of stuff interests me. Our average age is 36, we have 8 children, so that means that we have 4 to show for each of us, right? So that's, in one generation, we've increased by 4-fold in 36 years with our generation. So at this rate, you say, but you only have 8 children, but at this rate, if our children go at this rate that we have, it's only going to take 592 years to reproduce 7.8 million, a billion, 7.8 million, the population of the Earth.
That's pretty cool.
592 measly years. Not long. And it seems like, oh, that's strange to think that way. You know, when you think about Adam, you think about the population of the Earth. It's not that hard to take one person and create a population like the Earth's population. Just in a few generations. But this applies to the gospel, and this is why I brought it up. And I know it's kind of a little bit of a, maybe it's a memorable illustration, but if we reach one person, here's the thing. That illustration won't work if our children don't do what we did, right? It only works if their children do that, and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and it continues on throughout the generations. But in the same way, if we reach someone, but we don't really reach them, they're not going to have that mustard seed faith. They're not going to have the seed of truth planted as it should be to where it continues on to another generation. We need to reach someone with patience. Listen, if it takes us a year to disciple someone, or 2 years, or 10 years, or 20 years, discipling individuals is the key to changing the world. We need to care about individuals. That is the key. And if we'll do that, it makes a difference. I'm sure all of you have heard this before, but if you reach one person in 2021, okay, so 2021 is coming up here in just a few days, 2021, you reach one person. And then in 2022, you reach one more person, but you also reach somebody and disciple them to the place that they also want to go disciple and reach somebody in 2022. Then in 2022, you will reach another person, and that person that you disciple will reach another person. Does that make sense? Everybody with me? At this point, if you were to quit, but be successful at discipling them, if you were to die, you would be gone. And they continued doing that, just reaching one person for a year, and then the second year, the person they disciple reaches a person. It would be 3 people in 2 years that were reached. And it would take 21 cycles. That way, 21 groups of two. It would take that to the 21st power to reach over 10 billion. 21 cycles. That's only 42 years. It happened in our lifetimes. In 42 years. But we have to reach one person. We have to care about them. And here's the thing. It doesn't matter that you reach them in 1 year. It matters the way that you do it. And I can illustrate that because if it takes you 20 years to reach one person, or 20 years to reach 3 people, and you disciple one person for 10 years and disciple another person for the next 10 years, and they disciple one person for the next 10 years, and in 20 years you'll have reached 3 people. And it will only take a measly 420 years to reach the population of the Earth. If we are faithful to reach one soul at a time. It's not that long, because it's the type of faith that matters, not the time frame that we do it in. We have to care about individuals to where they care to continue on. That they know it's not some experiment. It's because we care, because we've adopted them, because we love them. And I believe Pastor Asquith is the great example of this principle. And I believe that the work of his life is going to continue, because it's not his work, but the work of his God, and that he cares about individuals. We need to reach others with mustard seed faith. You know, the mustard seed, it's not the size of it, it's the type of it. The mustard seed is a type of herb that grows and it becomes very large. I think about the cottonwoods. We had a tree in our front yard when I was growing up, and it was a cottonwood tree. And we called it, it was a big tree in the front yard, so we called it the big tree. And that was what everybody knew, that was the big tree. And it was a cottonwood tree. And those cottonwoods, they grow very quickly. They grow faster than most trees. And a lot of times they're weeds where they grow. People don't even want them, but they'll grow very quickly and they grow very big. And they're called cottonwoods because the seeds float around in little pieces of cotton. And if you were to look at that, they look very much like a mustard seed, but they grow into these enormous trees where you couldn't reach around it with two or three people around the trunk. They're so big. And they go up, very, very tall. I don't know. I would say over 100 feet. I've seen huge ones in my parents' backyard and all over. I don't know exactly how tall they go, but they're extremely tall trees and they grow huge. They start with these mustard seeds, tiny little, they're cottonwood seeds, but they're tiny like the mustard seed. And it's the type of seed that allows it to grow that great. And it's the type of faith that we express to someone else that allows it to grow and allows it to continue. We need to have that mustard seed faith that would grow and would continue and would not be left to wither away, to die, but that it would continue to grow. So this is the nature of brotherly kindness. As we are kind and patient with people, it's going to allow us to be able to touch their lives. And then as we reach others with that same kindness, sincerity, it's going to continue on into a second generation. And listen, raising a family, I learned some patience, and we have to learn patience. You can't just quickly be spontaneous and do whatever you want to do. You have a lot of things to think about. And as the children grow old, they start and they can't even roll over. They need a lot of help and it takes a lot of time. And as Christians, we need to see others around us this way. Don't just say, "Oh, the baby's born, and we'll throw it in a room, and we'll be fine. We're going to go out with life as usual." No, we've got to be kind. We've got to have these people, bring these people into our lives. We've got to bring one another into our lives. We need to build up the body of Christ. Just like raising our children, we need to build up one another and raise the family of God for His glory. I don't have a song for invitation here, but I don't know if you want to go ahead and play a song for me.